This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Since the 1940s, the United States has chosen a foreign policy of global dominance. But has this very preponderance of American power in fact made Americans less secure? This hour, rethinking America's grand foreign policy strategy. First, international eyes are on India and Pakistan today as the countries each announced sanctions against the other and reinforced troops at the border. I spoke with Rama Lakshmi today. She's a special correspondent with The Washington Post in New Delhi. I asked her how serious this latest round of escalations and sanctions is.
Let me start by giving you the description that India's foreign minister today used for relations between the two countries. Mm-hmm. He used one word, and he said tense. But if you look at what's happening on the border, the build-up and the troops and the deployment of missiles on both sides of the border, I hear that the last time such a huge build-up took place was in 1971 during the war. And it's never been this high along the border since then. So it's pretty serious.
So what measures have been taken now, Rama Lakshmi?
Well, the train links and the bus links were suspended last week. The High Commissioner, the Indian High Commissioner in Islamabad, he was called back. Today, both the High Commissions, India's High Commission in Pakistan, Pakistan's High Commission in India, will be scaled down to half its size.
In other words, the staff will be reduced.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And the families of those diplomats, Pakistani diplomats in New Delhi, they cannot move out of Delhi. They have to remain confined to the city of Delhi. And airspace has been denied for all flights, Pakistani flights and overflights in India. So it's pretty serious, but this was expected. There's a whole array of diplomatic tools that they've been talking about the past week. There are three or four more. One is revoking the trade treaty. Pakistan happens to be India's most favored nation as far as trade is concerned. Mm-hmm. There is talk in the diplomatic circles that that will be pulled out. Of course, the last arrow in their quiver, they keep saying, is the suspension of a water treaty, which would really be a very drastic measure.
That would cut Pakistan off from water supplies?
Right. There are three rivers in the north that supply water to farmers in Pakistan, and this was a treaty that was entered in the 70s, and India feels it's heavily biased towards Pakistan, so that it's an emotive issue, but I don't think they will get to that, but they will definitely keep that hanging.
That almost sounds like an act of war in itself.
In itself, yes, I would say that. But if you ask them that, what they say is the attack on Parliament was an act of war, too. It was that drastic. They want to utilize this opportunity to bring world's attention to terrorism in South Asia.
Washington, among others, has called for both sides to play it cool, saying that no one has anything to gain by going to war. How much influence does the U.S. have?
I think India depends a lot on the U.S. right now because India keeps saying we don't want war. So by tightening the diplomatic screws every second or every third day, they're really putting the pressure on more on United States than on Pakistan, because Pakistan may or may not take those steps that India wants them to take. But if George Bush puts that pressure, if Colin Powell puts that pressure, that's, I think, the message is really for the United States here.
You're suggesting that India feels it has more leverage right now because of Washington's involvement with Pakistan.
Absolutely. Although, politically, all the politicians will keep saying in India, we are disappointed with the double standards that the U.S. is showing. We are disappointed that Washington doesn't recognize this as terrorism. But they are really leaning very heavily on the United States. And a lot of this war gaming is much of it is just posturing right now, because nobody is really ready for war. The Indian Army is telling its leaders that we are not technologically prepared for war. So a lot of it is just posturing, putting pressure. And who are they putting pressure on at the end of the day? On Washington, to put pressure on Musharraf, because they say if anybody can, it's Washington.
But it's a dangerous game, this kind of posturing.
It really is. They're coming too close to war. They're flirting too dangerously with war. And missiles are being deployed, mm-hmm. and we both are nuclear neighbors. And it's a dangerous game they're playing. Already there's firing across the border, which takes place routinely throughout the year. But, you just need a spark.
Rama Lakshmi, what steps shy of war could resolve this standoff?
Well, India keeps talking about how they want Pakistan to recognize the enormity of what has happened on the day of the attack on Parliament. They keep talking about how Pakistan needs to recognize the outrage of Indians. Now, all this is just emotional stuff. General Musharraf has taken some steps, has frozen the assets, has tried to detain Maulana Azhar, the head of the now banned Jaish-e-Mohammed. But India keeps saying, we are not convinced, this is not enough. They want to the action. They keep saying this is all cosmetic. What they want is, I think, Musharraf to come out and say, we will condemn all kinds of terrorism. ISI will not help. ISI will choke all the money network, funding network to terrorist groups or militant groups that are fighting in Kashmir, which I don't think Pakistan will say right now. Even today, I was talking to a top level Indian official, and he says, I don't have too much confidence in diplomatic tools, but I am going to play the diplomatic game right now.
Which brings us back to the military. The Pakistani chief military spokesman was saying today that the nuclear weapons are for deterrent and not meant to be more than that. But he also said that Pakistan has the capacity to react or retaliate in all conceivable ways. If this should go to violence, what would be the break that would keep it from going nuclear?
I don't think they will go nuclear right now at all. That is just something that they will keep brandishing every now and then. Both countries did that during the Kargil border conflict in 1999. It's all rhetoric. Don't forget there are two crucial elections coming up in India, so a lot of it has to do with political posturing.
Rama Lakshmi is a special correspondent with the Washington Post in New Delhi. She spoke with me earlier today from New Delhi. Since the end of the Cold War, United States foreign policy has had one grand strategy: maintain military, economic, and political dominance around the globe at any cost. Some strategists say that massive dominance works because America acts not as a global dictator, but as a benevolent hegemon. But our next guest says it's time for the U.S. to rethink its grand strategy, and he points to the September 11th attacks as proof positive that the world has had it with America's global muscle. Has the very preponderance of American power actually made the U.S. less secure instead of more? Is it time for the U.S. to step out of the world's driver's seat and take a more modest seat on the bus? Would you risk a new grand strategy? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Christopher Lane. He's professor of international studies at the University of Miami and author of the forthcoming book, Peace of Illusions, International Relations Theory and American Grand Strategy Since World War II. Welcome, Christopher Lane.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Good to have you. And joining us tonight here in Boston is our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Christopher Lane, it's a very provocative piece you have coming out in the, I guess it's out in the January issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and I guess you're writing about it at book length as well. You say America's global strength is actually a form of weakness. Explain that for us.
It's not a simple concept. It doesn't reduce to a soundbite, but throughout history...
We've got all night, Christopher.
Throughout history, we see a pattern of states striving to become the dominant power in the international system and always being defeated by countervailing coalitions, because when one state is too powerful in the international political system, it threatens the security of others, and they combine, they form alliances in order to counterbalance the power of the dominant state. Now, this has happened time after time, going back to the time of Charles V, Philip II, both Habsburgs, France under Louis XIV and Napoleon, Germany under the Kaiser and Hitler. There is a very clear, definitive pattern. And the question is why should we assume that the United States will be exempt from that pattern?
Well, what's the evidence, what's the evidence, Christopher Lane, that it might not be?
That the United States
might
will not
be exempt from that pattern.
Well, there's certainly been a great deal of evidence, at least at the rhetorical level, since the Cold War ended. Leaders of many states, including U.S. allies, complaining about the imbalance of power in a so-called unipolar world where the United States is the only great power. We've seen leaders of countries, diverse countries, such as France, India, Russia, China, all calling for these emergence of a multipolar world in which American dominance could be contained and managed. Mm-hmm. Now, I will admit that there is a difference between rhetoric and action. And the fact is, today, there is no single state that is capable of counterbalancing the United States, and probably no coalition. But part of grand strategy is not just looking at the world today, but anticipating what is likely to happen in the coming decades. And clearly there is a great deal of unease with the current situation in international politics where one state is so powerful and so unconstrained.
And you've asserted that even the events of September 11th were somehow a result of American power.
Well, I don't think that's exactly what our argument is. I think the argument that we make, Ben Schwartz, my co-author, and I make in the article is that if you look at the rhetoric of al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, if you look at what's been going on among Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East and radicals, you can see there is a clear resentment of American power. And the demands bin Laden made were very much geopolitical demands that reflected a resentment of American influence in the Middle East. And unfortunately, those views resonate among a larger group of people in that region, which has historically been a region dominated by Western powers, the feeling of resentment that the dominance not only of the United States, but historically countries like Britain in the 19th century. So I think it is fair to say that certainly a lot of the hostility to the United States that we see in certain groups in the Middle East and reflects a resentment of American dominance in that region.
And yet, since September 11th, Christopher Lane, we've hardly seen the United States shrinking from a global role. If anything, George Bush, who had a more reserved foreign policy posture, has come out as more of an internationalist. We've got our gunships in the air and on the seas. The war on terror is portrayed as something that could take us anywhere, anytime in the world. We don't seem to be going for this kind of more nuanced, less globe-straddling policy that you are suggesting.
Well, again, if you read our piece in The Atlantic, our piece is very much a forward-looking piece. It's a prospective recommendation. I don't think there's any disagreement that the United States has to take these actions that we are taking in Afghanistan and possibly other places to protect ourselves after what happened on September 11th. The problem is that you have to look down the road and ask, what is our position going to be, not only in the Middle East, but in the world 5 or 10 years from now? And there is a paradox here. On the one hand, it is the very fact that America is so powerful militarily and economically that permits us to be very assertive in defending ourselves after the September 11th attacks. But it is that same power that invokes a tremendous unease, not only among states that are ones that we might expect to be somewhat suspicious of American power, but even among our allies who have sought in very subtle ways to try and constrain us even in the war against terrorism. I think that the question is not so much whether the United States is going to be internationalist or non-internationalist. It's whether we're going to have a strategy 5 or 10 years from now that continues to perpetuate unipolarity, where America's the only great power, or whether we're going to be able to manage a transition to a multipolar world where it's almost certain that there will be other great powers that try to emerge or, in Russia's case, reemerge, and whether we can find a way to turn that to our advantage rather than finding ourselves in a position where these other great powers 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road find common cause in checking American power.
Jack Beatty, Christopher Lane's article is in the magazine where you also work, but we'll listen to you anyway tonight.
Oh, I'm objective when it comes to Chris Lane. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
We seem to meet every 10 years when there's a war in the U.S.
Here we are again. Christopher wants us to take our foot off the military global hegemony pedal and have a more exquisitely nuanced diplomatic approach. What do you say?
Well, you know, it's not what I say. The Paul Wolfowitz, who's the now the Deputy Secretary of State of Defense, wrote about the U.S. needs to keep its allies under, quote, adult supervision, which gives the whole idea here of U.S. hegemony. We're Uncle Sam. We're the big daddy. You follow us. And one of the things Chris Lane is saying is, let them do it themselves. They'll do a good job.
Is it time for an end to American adult supervision of the post-Cold War world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with author Christopher Lane about a new posture of global humility as opposed to global hegemony for the United States, a new grand strategy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Is it time for America to come home and let the world take care of itself? Is global hegemony more trouble than it's worth? Christopher Lane, reading between the lines, or reading the lines of your Atlantic piece, it sounds as though you imagine a world in which the U.S. is not always the actor. It's not the big policeman on the block. In fact, it might be or have been Japan and Europe stationing troops to take care of the oil in Saudi Arabia, let's say. Is that right? And talk to us about your notion of offshore balancing.
Well, that is right. One of the interesting phenomena about American policy, American grand strategy since the end of the Cold War, is the determination of the United States not to allow any other state to become a great power and play a major role in international politics. Mm-hmm. And this extends especially to our allies in Europe and Japan, where we fear what policymakers in Washington call renationalization, that if we encourage them to defend themselves, bad things will happen. The international system will become unstable. Now, one could say this is a very unhistoric view of international politics, because what we've seen since the end of World War II, a bipolar world with the U.S. and the Soviet Union as the only two great powers, and then over the last decade or so, the U.S. as the only great power, is not the norm. Historically, the modern international system has been comprised of three, four, five, or six great powers.
And you'd like to see it that way again?
Well, there are a number of advantages for the United States in that kind of multipolar, as we political scientists call it, international system. And one of the advantages is that the United States can offload a lot of the very dangerous and costly security responsibilities it bears in other regions of the world to states whose interests are much more directly affected and implicated in those regions.
Lay that out plainly for us. How would that work?
Well, let's take the Middle East. I mean, let's not talk hypothetically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, Jack knows because, as he said, we meet seemingly every 10 years. The last time was
the
Persian Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Persian Gulf War, and I think Jack recalls the piece that he ran of mine, along with the piece by Joe Nye that were paired on a debate whether the Gulf War was in the national interest. And I suggested in my piece 10 years ago that although we won a very stunning triumph in the Persian Gulf, that in a way that would prove to be very ephemeral, because the region is extraordinarily volatile, as once again has been brought home to us. Now, are we going to find ourselves in a position where we try to keep the lid on in this region for another 10 or 15 or 20 years? And think about what that means. That means, are we going to intervene to prop up Saudi Arabia if and when that increasingly unpopular regime faces an internal insurrection? Look at the story that you covered just before we came on about India and Pakistan, which is very much related now to the American presence in Afghanistan has put us right in the middle of that conflict.
Christopher Lane, I want to be sure that
we want other states to take care of this region when they really have more at stake in it than we do.
Well, describe that to us. I want to be sure that's perfectly clear for our listeners. You're suggesting then that the United States pull back and as a result would find that other regional powers would step up and police their own regions. The U.S. wouldn't have to.
Want to make it very clear, we are saying that, but we are saying that prospectively after we finish taking care of business against the people who perpetrated these attacks against the United States. And we make it very clear in our article that it is right, proper, and necessary for the United States to defend itself and to go after the people who attacked our country. Mm-hmm. But in the long term, after we do that, there's still going to be a problem in this region. Europe and Japan and increasingly China are much more dependent on the energy of the Persian Gulf than the United States is. Russia and India have incredibly important security interests that are threatened by Islamic fundamentalism. Historically, a multipolar international system has been based on the recognition of spheres of influence where it is acknowledged that certain states have predominant or paramount interests in managing the security affairs of certain regions. Mm. And it's to our advantage, I would suggest, over the long term, to let others step up to the plate and take care of a region that in many respects is much more important to their security than it is to ours, even though we are the ones for the last 20 years who have been doing the lion's share of the stabilizing of that region.
Jack Beatty, Christopher Lane, but I want to bring Jack in. This posture that we've held for so long, as Christopher describes, of the global power, we've become so accustomed to it that the idea now, when we're under threat, under fire, of letting it down, is kind of nervous-making, as they'd say in London. But would you feel more comfortable, Jack, with the idea of Europe and Japan and maybe China taking responsibility for order in the Persian Gulf?
Doing with a little less adult supervision from the United States.
From Washington and the Pentagon?
It's appealing. I mean, we stations 100,000 troops in Europe to defend them against a now phantom threat. That's over $100 billion a year. We spend $100 billion a year defending the Persian Gulf. Against its own people, since there's no foreign, non-Arab, non-Muslim threat to the Persian Gulf. So it's sort of 1-800-America. We're bearing the burdens. And I think what Lane and Schwartz are saying is let's shift the burdens to the countries who have the larger stake. We have energy resources here. We could gear up and have an energy policy that could make us self-sufficient in energy or approaching that just by simply conservation, technology, a kind of Manhattan Project. So it's all conceivable. The trouble is, on the other side, is there is something to this notion of Pax Americana. You know, the Pax Britannica was obnoxious to many small peoples, but it was a real Pax. It kept the peace, at least among the great powers. And proxy wars like Korea and Vietnam aside, the Pax Americana, frozen by the Cold War and the nuclear stalemate, has kept the peace, too. By contrast, multipolarity, many great powers, has been a recipe in the past for great power wars. So empire has had its burdens. I think they're very right that September 11th is a massive burden, to say nothing of the cost of all this. But empire has also had a kind of benefit, too, in keeping great power peace.
Jack Beatty, Christopher Lane, hang on. We have callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking about a new U.S. grand strategy, maybe a strategy of global humility, or as Christopher Lane says, of offshore balancing. Let other great powers emerge and step up to take care of their part of the world. The U.S. wouldn't have to do it all. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I think that point that was just made about Pax Americana is exactly to the point. This sort of isolationist policy that's being advocated is very attractive because, you know, we're reacting to being attacked. But the fact is, you know, the rest of the world needs our adult supervision, and when we've tried to let them do it on their own, they've messed it up pretty well. Of course, World War II and World War I are good examples, but even more recently, you know, we originally decided we were going to let Europe take care of the whole Kosovo situation. They couldn't handle it. We had to come in and take care of it for them. And so, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately, rather, we're the only superpower, and there is, I think, something to be said for a Pax Americana. And your previous speaker was correct that this, when you have multiple powers, that's a recipe for competition and for war.
Tom, thanks for your call. Let's put it to Christopher Lane. And in fairness, Christopher Lane, we need to point out that you emphatically say that yours is not an isolationist position. The kind of balancing, diplomatic balancing you're describing would take, in fact, an incredible and nuanced and, you know, never sleeping engagement with the world. But it wouldn't be the big policeman. But what about Tom's point? Don't World War I and World War II look like examples where other great powers were left alone by the U.S. and they pulled the whole world into war?
Well, I think the answer to that question depends on what you think the world is really like. And as a realist, I would argue that war and competition, the rise and fall of great powers, the formation and dissolution of alliances are the very fabric of international politics, and that doesn't change. And yes, multipolarity is not a guarantee for peace throughout the international system, but neither is hegemony. And I suppose the ultimate question is, what is the role of the United States? Are we to dedicate ourselves to being the stabilizer and peacemaker for the international system, regardless of the cost to our own security and the fabric of our own society? Or are we to have more modest aims and recognize that we really cannot remake the world and try to carve out a role in the world, a diplomatic role through a balance of power / offshore balancing strategy that maximizes our own security, even if it doesn't lead to the reform of world politics, sort of the utopian vision that historically has always been a very, very strong tradition in American foreign policy, and one that I think, in my mind, has led us into to many unfortunate commitments that have not borne fruit.
Christopher Lane, stand by. David is on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask my question in the context of Mr. Lane's the comment that he just made about what determines the fabric of American society in the international picture. And is it unreasonable to think of the United States taking a position or a strategy which set out to make the world safe for humanity so that we could all be safe, and let that determine the fabric of American, in other words, to decide that whatever the fabric of American society has to be in order that the world becomes a safe place to live in, and that this issue of that we face now of someone having to be the policeman would essentially go away? I mean, that seems to me to be the longest term strategy, and that we would have to necessarily let go of some of our current notions about how life works in order to get there.
David, thanks for that. Thanks for your call. I have a feeling that Christopher Lane is going to go the opposite way. Christopher Lane, you describe grand vision as sort of the antithesis of what you're proposing here.
Yes, so our proposals are much more prosaic, and I guess I would use the word more realistic. Look, there have historically been two traditions in American foreign policy, and to boil them down to their simplest level, one has traditionally held that this country will find its greatness by remaking the world in its own image and exporting its ideals and institutions abroad. And the other, which has not prevailed in the last 60 years but still has strong roots and was prevalent up until World War II, is that the United States makes itself the kind of country that it wants to be by what we do here at home. That doesn't mean that we don't have interests in the world, but it means that if we want America to be great, we achieve that greatness in our own country, in our own borders, and not by trying to export our ideals to the rest of the world. As far as making the world safe for humanity, I mean, look, politics, international politics especially, is about power. Even domestic politics is about power. There is no order without some enforcing authority. As a hegemon, as Jack pointed out, the Pax Americana, the United States has assumed that role in the international system. But there are two things that we should be aware of. First of all, even a Pax Americana doesn't ensure complete peace and stability, as we've seen. And in the long run, even though policy of hegemony is extremely seductive, I mean, to be the most powerful state in the system seems to be a way to gain security. It seems attractive.
On the face of it.
But it doesn't work.
Jack Beatty, Christopher Lane's ready to throw out idealism in international politics and go to realism. The old inaugural speeches of JFK and Nixon come to mind.
They make an excellent quote.
Well, JFK says, we'll pay any price, bear any burden around the world in the pursuit of our ideals. Nixon says, we cannot expect to make everyone our friend, but we can try to make no one our enemy.
Sounds sensible to me. But, you know, they write that generally an offshore balancing strategy would hold that fatalism realism should replace idealism in America's attitude toward what used to be called the internal arrangements of other countries. I was once at a Washington dinner party, and there was an Argentine fellow there, and I got talking to him, and he looked at me and he said, "Do you know that I'm alive only because of Patricia Darien?" And I said, "Who the hell is Patricia Darien?" She was Carter's human rights person in the State Department. Here was a living, breathing person who was alive because we took an interest in the internal affairs of other countries. Mm. You know, we've taken an interest in the internal affairs of Bosnia, of Kosovo. We took no interest in the internal affairs of Rwanda. And I don't know that there can be many Americans who aren't but ashamed of that. Is this what we really want? The Nixon-Kissinger hands-off internal arrangement strategy didn't last beyond Nixon's resignations. Both the Republican right and the Democratic left attacked it, and they reflected a good deal of the public. We are not France. For that matter, we're not Britain. Universalist political ideals are just part of the national identity, and a care for the internal arrangements of other nations is built into our immigrant nation. Finally, this new grand strategy, forgetting about the internal arrangements of other countries, you know, that's where terrorism starts. We forgot about the internal arrangements of Afghanistan, and look what happened. Mm. So I don't know. This idea of hands-off and hands-off human rights, part of how we define ourselves is in terms of, you know, our what we stand for in the world. And if all we stand for is this sort of minimalism, I don't think that's certainly not, you know, that's a new idea, at least in the last 60 years.
Christopher Lane, what about it? Does the American character have what it takes to be that hands-off, to replace idealism with fatalism?
Obviously, I think so. And I think what's interesting here is that the political culture that promotes the belief that the United States can only achieve security by remaking the world in its image is very much an elite philosophy. It's not one that has wide support from the American public, who, of course, as we know, tend not to think very much about foreign policy, except at times like the one we're living in right now. Mm-hmm. It's fine to have ideals, but one also has to be pragmatic. The United States cannot reform the world if we hold the belief that we can only be safe and secure in a world of states that share our institutions and our political values. We will find ourselves in a perpetual crusade to remake the world that will result in innumerable foreign interventions, some of which will be costly. And I think we've seen that, you know, it's one thing to talk this game, but when it comes right down to it, the American people don't like going to war for idealism. They will go to war to protect their country. They will go to war to protect its security. But they will not go to war willingly for the purposes of mounting crusades.
Christopher Lane, stand by. We've got to take a break. We can hear our kind of fluctuating view of this, even in our conversation tonight. On the one hand, very seductive not to be out there as the big policeman. And as you say, Christopher Lane, maybe it's the very thing that invites the kind of blow we took on the 11th. On the other hand, if we're not out there paying attention to Afghanistan, nobody else was. Listeners, what do you think? Is it time for America to come home and let the world take care of itself? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is WBUR. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about a new grand strategy for the United States with Christopher Lane, professor of international studies at the University of Miami and author of the forthcoming book, Peace of Illusions, International Relations Theory and American Grand Strategy Since World War II. Christopher Lane is proposing that instead of being the global policeman, we become the one of several great powers, and we balance those offshore powers to preserve peace and to pursue our own interests. What about it? Does being the global superpower simply make the United States a target? And if the U.S. stands down, will the world stand up? Would our allies and enemies take better care of their own regional problems? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Ali is on the line. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up a point. I think you were right on the money when you said, even through your conversation, it seems like you're flip-flopping between
the sentiments go both ways tonight.
Yeah, I think the main reason for that is that you're looking at this sometimes through the prism of American liberalism and sometimes through the American interest in the region.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think that what's causing all this problem is the liberal acts of the United States in the world. I don't think that's the reason, but I think the presence of these interests requires America to be everywhere and try to keep hands in every issue that comes up.
But Ali, Christopher Lane is saying that the U.S. doesn't have to be dependent on Persian Gulf oil, that we could develop alternative supplies, and then it would be more up to Europe and Japan, those nations that would be dependent, to watch out for some stability there. Would you be more comfortable with that?
Well, you know, I'm not in the administration, but I'm pretty sure the people in the government know exactly what they're doing. And if you look throughout the history, every time push comes to shove, you need the military, and the military has moved in from Vietnam all the way to Korea and the oil crisis or the problem with Iraq. It's not... I really think that this is required, and I don't know. I don't have facts and numbers in front of me, nor I think I'm qualified to make suggestions about
it.
Let's
put it to Christopher Lane then, Ali, and we thank you for your call. Christopher Lane, what about it? Let's say that there... we turn back the hands of time or look forward and imagine Iraq once again going after neighboring oil fields if the U.S. didn't intervene. And granted, you're describing a prospective vision here, but look down the road. How might that work out?
Well, part of our prospective vision is something that Jack alluded to earlier. It's adopting a policy, something akin to the Manhattan Project, to achieve energy self-sufficiency so that we don't have to spend the amount of money maintaining military forces to intervene in the Persian Gulf and seemingly every 10 years or so send them over there to fight.
But aren't you suggesting that ultimately it would be someone else's problem, that it wouldn't have to be U.S. forces there? And whose would it be, and what would prevent them from getting into a war over that oil if it were Japan and Europe and China scrabbling for it?
Well, international politics being what it is, and the Middle East being what it is as a particularly volatile and unstable region, there is nothing that can assure any of us that over the long term the United States is going to be able to stabilize this region. So then the question becomes which states should bear the primary responsibility for stabilizing it. And that gets back to the question I think that has sort of been percolating here but not really answered. Which I suppose, will other states step up to the plate? I think, as you phrased it, Tom, will they step up or stand back?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons that we have never seen other states step up to the plate, even going back to these great burden-sharing debates with our European allies during the Cold War, is because in the final analysis, others believe that the United States does these things. When I say these things, I mean, makes these kinds of security commitments because we believe it's fundamentally in our interest to do it, whether others do their fair share or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of what political scientists call collective action problem, which I guess your listeners would know from pledge time. I mean, it's easy to listen even if you don't pledge. Well, it's easy to consume security if there's a big power like the United States willing to provide it, even if you don't make a big contribution yourself as a state. For this kind of strategy that we're proposing to work, the United States needs to find a way over time to convince others that it means what it says if we were to say we are standing back from this region or that.
And you're going to have to pick it up and deal with it.
And you are going to have to assume the burden of providing security and stability. Mm-hmm.
Christopher, let's try and get one more call before our time runs out. Art is calling from Edenborough, Pennsylvania. Hello, Art.
Hello.
Hi, Art.
Sorry for the sound of my voice. Consequence of surgery.
We're with you. We got you loud and clear.
Good. The one word I have not heard yet is the word arrogance in this discussion of hegemony, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
American arrogance. Because prior to September 11th, which, of course, our president could do nothing to be aware of, we were decided to tell the rest of the world we can do without them. Mm-hmm. He pulled out of agreements. He pulled out of treaties. He said, we don't need you. America can do it by itself. I believe that's called arrogance. Then, after the 11th, everybody wanted to be our buddy. Mm-hmm. Secondly, again, on the order of arrogance, domestically speaking, he was advised repeatedly, take it easy on the tax rebate. We have an enormous budget surplus. Leave a little bit. He did not. He gave everybody back their big deal, $300 and $600.
Right. There was no time for that. Art, our clock is running down, but I want to put your point to Christopher Lane, and thank you for your call, Christopher Lane. We've just got a minute left. But what about, Art says, it's American arrogance that we can be hegemons perhaps, but not with such an arrogant posture.
Well, I think there's always a tendency for others to perceive a dominant power as being arrogant, but I'm not sure that that's the substance of the problem. And the problem is that great powers historically are unilateralist. All great powers are unilateral. They put their own interests first. It's not to say that they don't form alliances or cooperate with others, but they put their own interests first.
And was George Bush on the kind of path that you're describing before 9/11? As Art points out, he was resisting a lot of global leadership at that time, and certainly cooperative leadership.
Well, I think the United States, as an unprecedentedly powerful state, has the ability to go its own way a lot of the time, and it's very difficult to resist that temptation. And in the short term, it is a seductive policy. The question is, again, it's not arrogance, it's power. It's the fact that there is this rooted pattern in international politics that when one state becomes too strong, other states become very concerned about their own security, and ultimately they do something about it. So in the short term, hegemony seems like a winning strategy. In the longer term, it has never proved to be a winning strategy. Mm. And unless you believe that the United States somehow enjoys a historical exemption, and I do not believe that, mm-hmm. We have to look down the road and ask ourselves, how do we ensure our security? How do we ensure that we do not fall victim to the same hegemonic backlash that has brought low those other contenders for hegemony that we discussed earlier in the show.
Christopher Lane, we feel that we've not even begun to hear the end of this argument, and you make it well. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Lane is professor of international studies at the University of Miami and author of the forthcoming book, Peace of Illusions, International Relations Theory and American Grand Strategy Since World War II. You can read the full article that describes his position, his theory, in the January edition of the Atlantic Monthly. You can get into the conversation also on our website at wbur.org. Jack, final thoughts?
He quotes Edmund Burke 200 years ago about the British Empire. He said, among precautions against ambition, it may not be amiss to take one precaution against our own. I dread our being too much dreaded. I dread our being too much dreaded. I guess that's what they're warning about here.
We do not want to be too much dreaded. But whether we should be the big power or one among many, that's the question. Which would ultimately work better? Wow, it's a big one. Listeners, check out a history of American foreign policy issues, isolationist, interventionist, or maybe the offshore balancing approach of Christopher Lane at our website, wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage. Now, the second part in our series of conversations with poet Robert Pinsky about poetry and times of conflict. As poet laureate during the Clinton administration, Pinsky started the Favorite Poem Project. The project collected the stories of Americans from all walks of life reading their own favorite poem. Tonight, Robert Pinsky shares a reading from the Favorite Poem Project that speaks of national identity and historical identity and poems as national documents. Robert Pinsky.
A terrific example is Ralph Waldo Emerson's Concord Hymn, which is indeed a hymn. Emerson wrote the poem to be sung at the dedication of the monument here in Massachusetts, in Concord, and it was indeed sung on that occasion. And it is an unusual work in that I think it's an extremely distinguished piece of writing that's also a fairly conventional patriotic poem. Very much about the American Revolution.
Who reads this now?
A very good question, Tom. This poem is read by President William Clinton.
Let's hear it.
By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. The foe long since in silence slept, alike the conqueror in silence sleeps. In time the ruined bridge has swept down the dark stream which seaward creeps. On this green bank, by this soft stream, we set today a votive stone, that memory may their deed redeem when, like our sires, our sons are gone. Spirit that made those heroes dare to die and leave their children free, bid time and nature gently spare the shaft we raise to them and thee.
President William Jefferson Clinton reading Ralph Waldo Emerson's Concord Hymn as part of the project that Robert Pinsky, then National Poet Laureate, started to collect favorite poems. Robert Pinsky, here we have a president, famously not a soldier, reading a war poem. Connect the dots for us.
Well, like the present president, President George W. Bush, President Clinton had never seen combat. Emerson's poem is very, very much about memory. The bridge that was defended by the farmers has been swept away at the time that he writes. The conquerors are dead. The defeated are dead. The British soldiers are dead. The farmers are dead. And Emerson actually says that he's hoping that he's participating in putting up a stone or memorial that will go on and will be seen after his children are dead. It gives the poem a kind of eerie quality of being addressed directly to us, since in a literal sense, Emerson's children are dead. And that brilliant, much-quoted phrase, shot heard round the world, much paraphrased, it's been vulgarized, it was a brilliant piece of phrase-making as part of a wonderful poem. It has to do with memory. And what we hope for war and battle, we hope that it will be a matter of memory rather than a matter of experience. We hope that our children won't experience it. And there's a special emotion connected to remembering the heroism of people who killed and were killed. Mm. And it also involves a hope that they will be remembered and not reiterated, that it won't happen again. Mm.
You know Bill Clinton, and he chose this poem. What does a poem like this, for Bill Clinton or for any American as a citizen, how does it connect us with our national understanding of the meaning or purpose of war?
I think it's a very simple historical charge. They were farmers. They weren't soldiers. And their flag, we hope, represented the principle of freedom. We hope it still represents the principle of freedom. And former President Clinton is an extremely intelligent and extremely well-read man. And I would agree with those who say that he's very aware of the question of his legacy and memory. And I think that for him, it was doubtless a poem not only about heroism and war, but also a poem about memory and history and cleaving to principles that were established and defended by people who are no longer here. And while we may not literally be their descendants, we may be descended from immigrants who came to the country a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 100 years ago. We are in some sense their descendants. So I think on his part, I'll speculate that it was something like piety toward ancestors and towards what the ancestors mean.
Robert Pinsky is a former U.S. Poet Laureate and the creator of the Favorite Poem Project. To read and listen to more poetry from the project, visit our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. You can tune in next Wednesday for Part 3 of our series with Robert Pinsky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.